1963.
We were talking about problems. We'll say, before I begin, I want to make a little announcement or tell you that next Wednesday, I'll lecture till about 3. I have to be in the Department of Agriculture in Washington the next morning quite early. And in order to make it, I have to catch a plane. And we have some housekeeping business to do, and this will offer us an opportunity to get it done. I'll clear out and you can get the work done. I think this is the last time that I'll have that trouble because the times change at the end of October. And we don't have the difference in time then between Iowa City and the other parts of the country. I'm not going to be leaving very much anyway. We were talking about the problem, a kind of pattern of personal problems, the IFD pattern, and the Aristotelian language structure, which appears to be related to it. I talked about this in order to relate the study of symbolization, language, communication to a kind of concern that would be of interest to all of us. Our basic concern in the course is not really with symbols and language, communication. It is with the practical effects, the problems and the kinds of accomplishment which these functions make possible. We're especially concerned with approaches to problems that would be effective approaches. So I want now to go on to consider some of the fundamental kinds of orientation that we have to problems. This word orientation will occur over and over, and we'll get on to it as we go along. I may have the next slide on. I mean in general by it to include the patterns which we tend to exhibit in our behavior and form a kind of a readiness or preference for behaving in certain ways. Can you make notes all right now with that? You probably see that better. I'll try again to reduce the sunlight here. All I mean to represent by this is that in very broad terms, we tend to approach problems in a scientific way. This doesn't mean a technically scientific way. I mean only by this that we tend to, so far as we are scientific in our approach, we tend to concentrate on finding out what the facts are as best we can, using these words now in the way we usually use them, as far as I know. We try to deal with the facts as we can determine them. We are governed by them in the way we form the attitudes with which we operate and the opinions with which we operate and the actual courses of action that we develop to deal with the problem. Now, when we don't do this, we do something else, which, for want of a name, I have called magic. This name has a certain connection with history. I don't mean to talk in these terms in hard and fast ways, but I merely want to point to some essential distinctions. By magic, I mean mainly the approach to problems, which consists essentially or mainly of following some type of an authorized procedure. You don't look at the facts. You don't try to determine the facts necessarily. You may not consider that the facts are relevant, that there are any facts that are relevant. You are at pains to do the right thing according to some authority which you respect, which you accept. And so this is a way of dealing with problems by essentially ceremonial means. The Navajo rain dance is an example. Nobody really checks up to see whether it rains. But there is a way to do the rain dance. And one concentrates on doing the rain dance in the right way. Now this is a magical orientation. If you become highly enough aware of this distinction, then you are able to make observations about your own behavior and that of other people, members of your family, or of your organizations you belong to, and so forth, people generally, with regard to the degree to which they are behaving in an essentially magical way, or in a sense, a scientific way, although they may not be able to be very scientific. Nevertheless, they are trying to deal with the facts. They may not be able to very well, and a rigorous researcher would have disdain for what they do. But at least the intention is scientific. They are not just doing something because someone says it's the right thing to do, or because this is the thing that has always been done. I think we need another word, non-scientific, but it's hard to say what we might mean by it. And I'm going to use it in a very loose way, primarily to reduce arguments to a minimum. Let's say there is a middle sort of a gray zone in which we are not in any very definite way just behaving magically, nor are we in any very definite way behaving scientifically. We're sort of sleepwalking through this. And to avoid argument, let's just call it non-scientific and non-magical, if you want to. I've drawn the ellipses the way I have just to indicate one fact, as I would consider it. I consider it to be a fact. Can you hear me over there? That we are, for the most part, most of us, most of the time, we're more oriented magically than we are scientifically. this is my opinion. Does anybody on the panel want to take exception to that? For instance, Sharon Bauer, do you find what I have just said agreeable to you? We are. Try to talk to Bugler. Thanks. Okay. Anytime you want to speak up, please do. I'll try to ring you in on it as much as I can do that. Let's have the next slide. After all, we haven't had anything that you could call conscious scientific behavior for much more than 300 or 400 years. It's very, very new in the world. So that we still pretty largely go by, we are oriented in terms of what people did before there was anything like highly conscious science. There are very few people today who know how to behave scientifically in any very, very detailed or systematic fashion. And so that's why I think we are going to be realistic in our perspective. We would say that we are, for the most part, much more oriented magically than we are scientifically. We tend to remain that way, as I have tried to indicate by this little steam, because we share our basic orientations with other people, our families especially, our friends, and we don't easily give them up. If we are highly oriented magically in any respect, along with our families, we tend even to be rather not just disinterested, but perhaps even a bit hostile to facts which would tend to suggest that we might review our established points of view or beliefs or attitudes or orientations. And I think that every teacher ought to be highly aware of this, and every person who works with people, every lawyer, every doctor, every clinician of any kind, you are asking a person to do something terribly, terribly important to him, terribly hard for him to do, when you ask him to change very much his basic orientation to the world about him, to other people, his patterns of thinking, of dealing with problems. It isn't only that doctors don't have time, considering the number of doctors we now have, of course. If we had enough doctors, it would be different, but the doctors we now have, it isn't only that they don't have time to try to educate the patient, to solve his problem in a sort of a scientific way, to keep records, for example, of what he eats and of how he feels, and to do this long enough to get some sense of how he reacts to foods. Now, if you're going to deal scientifically with digestive problems, with allergies of various kinds and so forth, with the weight control problem, this is how you do it. But that isn't how most patients do it. it is more in keeping with their magical orientation for the doctor to give the patient a pill. This is magic. And it's a rare patient who asks, what's in the pill? He doesn't react to the pill the way a chemist would. He reacts to the doctor as to the magician. And the pill is magic. As magic as anything you could find in witchcraft. For most patients, not all, and not for all doctors, and not for any doctor all the time, but in general, we react to people who try to help us as though to magicians. Even teachers have to adjust to this. Your inclination probably is to look on me as a person who knows somehow in a mysterious way, knows things. I just know things. No, I don't. And it's very hard to get that across to most students. You've been taught to think of anyone who would be in a position I'm in, doing what I am doing, as a kind of a magician. I will teach you. And if I try hard enough, I may get a few of you to abandon that orientation and really to begin to behave scientifically. In this relationship. What about it, panel? You got any urge to do that?
I'm not sure I'm clear on what you mean by behaving scientifically.
Can we wait a while? I've got the I have an answer for you, which I can give you better in a kind of orderly way. You mind?
No.
Okay. So let's go on to the next slide. Here begins it. If you're going to try to deal with problems scientifically, and I wish I had another word for it, because I don't mean as a physicist, I don't mean as a chemist, I mean as you, moment to moment, dealing with any problem. You will be concerned with change, with experimentation, with functional relationships, with truth in lowercase. That means for the time, for the place, relative to the circumstances that you're talking about, and to you, or the observer in question, and not truth for everybody for all time. And so you are concerned, you assume, and you deal with reality as a process, and you feel this. This is a kind of a constant assumption or orientation that you are constantly dealing with processes, and therefore with changes, and therefore with functional relationships. That is, something is a function of something else. As one thing changes, so does another thing. And you are interested in those relationships. What goes with what? As you change in any respect, in what you would call maturity, however you want to measure, what else changes? What goes with that? Or what does that go with? What are the conditions for that kind of change. You are interested sometimes in trying to experiment, actually arrange observations so they'll be more effective, more revealing. Controlling certain conditions to notice their effects more exactly. But that isn't essential to being scientific. It's a refinement. Often mistaken for, I think, the whole of science. Now, if you're not concerned with those things, if this isn't in the focus of these, if these are not in the focus of your interest and your preoccupation, your engagement, probably, to some degree, you are concerned with things like this. You are assuming that there is some kind of truth in an absolute sense, and you're trying to discover it. Or you are trying to keep change from happening. Change is an abnormality to anyone who thinks of reality as consisting of eternal verities. And change is bad. We're always returning to normal. It's odd, isn't it? Almost no politician or anyone else in our culture talks about going forward to something more normal than we have now. There's a kind of tendency to take for granted that once upon a time there were good old days. And ever since, things have been going to pot. Because they've been changing. One of the most interesting forms this takes is that of the linguistic purist for whom the English language is going to pot. It's always going to pot. We're using new words that he's never heard of before. We're using words like jive and finalize. And he just can't stand it because this means that there is change going on in the language and this is bad. The assumption is that language is somehow fixed. There is a right, normal, and proper language. It has been established, it has come into being, and it should not ever be altered. You're going to find Hall's book fascinating, I think, from this point of view. Well, you can find your own ways to be sensitive to this kind of basic orientation, as though no change were the desirable state, as though change were abnormal, as though truth were for all time, for everybody, everywhere, the same. And so, in that kind of a world, with that kind of an orientation, the orientation is necessarily to authority. It is authoritarian. There is always somebody who is the authority, who knows what is, who knows what is right, who knows what you should do, and so you solve your problems by going to the authority to find out what to do now. What do I do now? And somebody will tell you. I use in the book the technical term, the old man. I mean that as a technical term. The old man of the tribe. From basic magical kind of society. The old man of the tribe was the person who occupied a special role. And in our own society, we have old men of the tribe in an essential sense, in different forms, with different titles, and playing somewhat different roles. But we still have the old man as a kind of authority. It can be any kind of authority. And this means then that we tend to pay major attention to ceremony, to tradition, to the way things used to be and always have been done. Traditional way of doing things is highly valued in a magical society. The innovator is suspect. The original person is suspect. He is a nuisance in the magical society. He is abnormal, possessed of the devil, they used to say. The evil one. Who had new ideas. Who did not want to follow the ways of the elders. The old man, and to do things in the traditional way. This was bad in the magical society. So far as we are addicted to conformity, we tend to share this kind of orientation. What is the college student supposed to wear this fall? How do you do? Determine that scientifically? Or do you read Mademoiselle? Oh, I don't know what you read. So there's a good deal of attention to form as distinguished from function. The form of the statement is what matters. To a linguistic purist, for example, who is addicted in this kind of context, it would be said he's addicted to verbal magic. There is a right way to say everything. Whereas to the functionalist, the function of language is to communicate effectively. Don't bother about the form. And if you are able to communicate more effectively in a new form, this is highly valued. And so in our more scientific kind of a society that we are developing very slowly, we do have an increasing number of artists, for example, who develop new forms. Poets and novelists who don't try to write like anyone else. Even Hemingway anymore. But who are trying to develop new forms. They are not addicted to old forms. Form is something also to be changed. And they are more interested in achieving some kind of function with what they do. Well, perhaps this will help us a little bit to get the distinction I'm attempting to draw. By non-scientific, non-magical, I don't quite know what to mean, except perhaps the behavior we indulge in are the persons, if you want to put it that way, who are not very conscious. They couldn't tell you which they're doing. But I don't like this way of talking, because if you examine what they are doing, you would be able characterize it. as being more in one direction than the other. This is not a dichotomy. I'm trying to define two ends of a continuum, of a scale. And you fall in the middle of it, or you fall more to one end than the other at any given moment, or on the average. The next slide, please, Audrey. Another way that you can try to make the distinction I'm trying to make is by using a couple terms, conscious and unconscious, which we're practically using as basic undefined terms. By which I mean, if you don't know what you mean by conscience, it's pretty hard to tell you. And so we will use these words as though we knew what they meant, for the most part. Now, we could talk about it a while. You can say that, in part at least, you demonstrate that you are conscious of what you are doing or of anything by your ability to verbalize about it. But that doesn't make everybody happy. So let's don't try to define these words. Let's use these words as undefined terms. So each of you will define them in your own way if you define them. And so we'll settle for that now. Go ahead. In the scientific orientation, you are conscious that you are symbolizing. You are conscious that you are using your symbol system in your way, with your habits, with your preferences, with your tendencies to say one thing rather than another, or to say things in certain ways. You are consciously abstracting if you're a painter. You know that there are no non-abstract paintings. If any painting is an abstraction, a photograph is an abstraction. If you are a scientifically oriented painter, you know this. And so you consciously abstract. If you are magically oriented, you don't know this, and you think you are really you think you're really painting a cow. You really think you are. You're unconscious of abstracting. You don't know you're abstracting. You think that... I think I described such a painter in the book. I met her in a mental hospital, in the occupational therapy room. And she had a painting there, which she had done. It was a blob of blue. And I asked her to tell me about it, and she said, well, that's the war. And I said, well, what do you mean, the war? Well, it's the war. Well, tell me about it. Well, that's the war. And that's all I could get out of it. She didn't apparently know that was an abstraction. To her, that was the war. If it had been a cow, that was the cow. And that's the way a cow should look. See? And that's the way the war should look if you paint it. Well, I met her in a mental hospital. But you don't always meet people like that in mental hospital. They are not conscious that they're abstracting. They don't know about abstracting. They really don't. They think they are faithfully, objectively, somehow reproducing, representing something that they call reality, which they somehow assume is the same for all people who are right-minded. If you are conscious that you are symbolizing, that you are abstracting and symbolizing, then you are also aware that you are projecting your abstractions onto the canvas, onto the page, into the airwaves. You are projecting. And the magically oriented person doesn't appear to be aware of projection as a process. He doesn't know he's talking about his own insides. He thinks he's talking only about the outside. The lady who says that is the war didn't appear to realize that she was projecting something inside her nervous system that we can call, in the form we see it in, an attitude or preconception or assumption, something of the sort. Right.
Might we be too magically oriented if we were to say that for her that blob of blue was the war, although in more real terms it was not?
Might you be too magically oriented if you were to say that?
That's what I'm asking.
I think you would, if I follow what you have said, you would be quite scientifically oriented if you were to say that. The way you said it. For her, that is the war. Yeah. Let's have the next slide, Audie. So now, we have grown up, however we have grown up, wherever we have, and we come to September 30th, 1963, Iowa City, to the Geology Auditorium at 3:30, or whatever the time is, almost. Having learned, to some degree, to deal with our world in a magical way, or a scientific way, or some combination of these. Now let's take an extreme case of a person who has been highly taught, very effectively tutored, to accept authority of a certain kind, to be highly oriented to this authority, to solve problems by going to the authority to find out what's to be done, what he should do, who assumes that the truth that he is to operate with is a universal truth, unchanging, consists of eternal verities, and so forth. He's learned his lessons well because he's been a very obedient sort of a pupil. Now what is the relation of his past learning then to the learning which he may now undertake that would be in the spirit of a scientific approach to the world and to problems? Well, I think it's quite obvious that the more he has learned in the past, the better, can you hear me? The better he has learned his lessons. Tell him to... The more his past learning will retard or block his present learning. There's a general principle here that so far as what one has learned is incompatible with what one is now learning, then the effect on the present learning process will be to retard it, or possibly to block it altogether. Yeah, I think we always deal with a kind of a mixture. We are, if I got what you are trying to present, you are presenting a fairly realistic and common sort of experience. The thing I would want to call attention to is the answer you give to this question. When you come across something in a book, a journal, which sounds to you like a new conclusion, a new theory, or even new information, and which sounds as though it contradicted what you have been taught to believe. Now, what do you do? Do you take a poll of the authorities known to you and govern yourself by the results of the poll? If you do, then this, of course, is magical behavior. You're passing the buck to someone else to make up your mind for you. Or do you try in your own way to examine the situation? Go back and read the original articles which support the contrary theory or point of view. If there are no articles, well, try to review what you know about the situation. And for yourself, consider which is the better theory. Now, you may not do this well. You may be handicapped greatly in not having access to all the information you need. You might possibly lack a course in mathematics or something, which would be helpful if you had it. But it is the orientation that I'm interested in. What do you try to do? Which way do you tend to lean? Well, you don't need to answer unless you want to, but I'm asking the question of everybody, not this group. Did you ask a question, and did I answer it at all? I'm not here really to answer questions, but, yes? Go ahead. Now, so far as I see nothing in about past learning that would be incompatible with present learning. So far as your past learning has yielded information and has left you open-minded. That's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the hazards. I mean, it happens here as well as in the other courses. This is the same phenomenon that you see in the advertisement. In which science says, okay. General Semantics says, Dr. Johnson says, science says, this is magic. And I hope this isn't what you're going to learn. But it's, I think there is a good likelihood that many students would come out of any kind of a course like this talking that way, as though they had found a new authority. Because it's very, very difficult to alter this basic orientation. If you alter enough, you really can't go home again, you know. Not really. Yes, physically, of course, you can go anywhere. But you do have to make new friends, you will. If you alter your orientation enough, you're not likely to. I think it would be amazing if you did. And so you'll probably go out defending some of the things you say by quoting Dr. Johnson. That's too bad. And the fact that you laugh, I think, indicates that you understand what I mean. Let's have the next slide, if there is. There's a great deal of argument among those who try to address themselves to the question of what is science, and yet there is, on a certain level, a great deal of agreement. There's agreement to the general effect that what we call scientific behavior, and again, I'd like to remind you, I wish we had another word for it, because I'm afraid you associate this with laboratories or something, and I'm trying to talk about a behavior, a kind of behavior that you can exhibit all day long. This has nothing to do specifically or definitively with laboratories or with certain fields. This is simply a pattern of orientation and behavior. It consists in asking observations would be relevant. That's the key to it. You ask questions that can be answered to some degree by observations which can be made or have been made or might be made. You talk about, that is, you ask about something that someone could know something about. This is why science, in its more highly developed forms, is so productive. There's a minimum of waste of energy and time trying to answer meaningless questions. Questions that can't be answered by any amount of observations that anybody can make. There is a kind of built-in honesty in this behavior, in that the report is very carefully drawn, very carefully made. You make the best observations you can. If you don't, you're not being scientific. If you cheat, that isn't scientific. Your report is as accurate as you can make it. If it isn't, to the degree that it is ambiguous and careless, you're not being scientific. You're acting as though it doesn't matter what you say the facts are, what you say you saw, observe. But if you are behaving scientifically, then you are imbued with the feeling that it does matter very greatly what the facts are and what you say they are. This isn't a moral matter. The honesty is built into the method. It's the only pattern of behavior I know that has honesty built into it. By definition, if you violate the... if you don't observe as well as you can, if you don't report as accurately as you can, you're violating the method. You're not being a good player of the game. And from the report you make, you draw conclusions. We're going to read a book by J.Z. Young called Doubt and Certainty in Science. And after you have read this book, what I have done here will be more meaningful to you. What you arrive at is not a hard and fast conclusion. You arrive at a certainty about which you have the least doubt, as of the moment. And you have enough doubt about it to raise some more questions. So you make some more observations and some more reports, and so you arrive perhaps at another kind of certainty about which you have a little less doubt. But you never get over your doubt. The doubt never replaces the certainty, and the certainty never replaces the doubt. It's always sort of a state of doubt and certainty, as though this were all one word. And so it is endless. You never get done. You never find the answer. Now, I don't think anybody who knows, who has tried to examine what people do, who work scientifically, and who have tried to extend this behavior to a generalized pattern, would argue much with this basic kind of a statement. Now, we'll argue endlessly about details, about how the observations should be made. They will describe the behavior of scientists. No two scientists behave exactly alike, of course. One of them has to take a walk in the woods before he can have an idea, and another one has to drink three cups of coffee at 4 a.m. before he can get going, and so on. Well, these are irrelevant little sort of ritualistic incidentals, it seems to me. But this basic procedure seems rather fundamental. We'll go on from there, Wednesday.